Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Everyday Anarchism, the show that finds anarchism, cooperation, non-domination, mutual aid in your everyday life. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and this is part of my ongoing series on David Graeber's Debt, Chapter 5. I don't know exactly when you are hearing this. Obviously, at the beginning of 2024, the show was on a bit of a hiatus, as the series was as well. The Henry Farrell episode got delayed. Everything was on pause. Hopefully, we're back to regular publishing. Roughly every other week, three times a month would be the ideal. I've got too many things going on, including teaching, to do more than that. I do need to welcome aboard Tony, a listener who has started editing the interviews. I'm still editing these solo episodes, but I would not be able to make these solo episodes if Tony were not helping out. Thanks so much, Tony. So back to debt. We are now in Chapter 5, a brief treatise on the moral grounds of economic relations. Later this month, there'll be a conversation with the economist James K. Galbraith, in which we talk about debt and economics more broadly. But for now, Chapter 5. Chapter 5 is huge for two reasons. The first one is personal to me. That's why it's huge. As you know, the main idea of this podcast is that everything runs on anarchism at some fundamental level. I've extended this idea to all sorts of things, which are so obviously not anarchism, the Roman Empire, capitalism, the Federation of Star Trek, farmers markets, Batman, America. I hope to do one on the Japanese shogunate. But this basic idea isn't mine, it's Graeber's. And although Graeber expresses this concept frequently, and if people ask me where to find it, I usually send him to his article, Are You an Anarchist? The Answer Might Surprise You, something like that. But it's actually best expressed, most clearly expressed, in Chapter 5 of Debt. This is the inspiration for my concept of everyday anarchism. Here's a great quote that gives you this. Starting, as I say, from the principle of from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs, allows us to look past the question of individual or private ownership, which is often little more than formal legality anyway, and at much more immediate and practical questions of who has access to what sorts of things and under what conditions. Whenever it is the operative principle, even if it's just two people who are interacting, we can say we are in the presence of a sort of communism. And the operative principle, he means the from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. All right, back to the quote. Almost everyone follows this principle if they are collaborating on some common project. If someone fixing a broken water pipe says, hand me the wrench, his coworker will not, generally speaking, say, and what do I get for it? Even if they are working for ExxonMobil, Burger King, or Goldman Sachs. The reason is simple efficiency. Ironically enough, considering the conventional wisdom that communism just doesn't work. If you really care about getting something done, the most efficient way to go about it is obviously to allocate tasks by ability and give people whatever they need to do them. All right, that's the end of the quote. I think this is pretty clear. You know, Kropotkin uses the example of taking care of elderly family members and of passing plates at dinner and of jumping in the pond to save people. This is communism. And it's also anarchist. It's anarcho-communism because this communism isn't being enforced by a party vanguard. Anarchist communism. It's what literally everything runs on in the day-to-day. Hence, everyday anarchism. This leads right into the other really big thing about Chapter 5, is where Graeber develops a theory of the three ways that society can be organized. This is one of the places where he does like capital A anthropology. The three ways are communism, hierarchy, and exchange. And exchange is also sort of understood as reciprocity or equality. I'll go into each one of those, and when this episode is done, I think you'll feel good about understanding how Graeber defines those terms, and we can see how they work in everyday life. And also how truly impractical hierarchy and exchange are, at least if there's not a healthy dose of communism there. These things are, as Graeber puts it, luxuries no one can afford when we need to accomplish something. Which, this is just such a great inversion, because we're always told that hierarchy and exchange get things done, and communism is a luxury that no one can afford. But this is obviously wrong. Everything is done by communism. Everything besides communism, including hierarchy and exchange, are only done on top of and in addition to communism. Or as Graeber puts it in a variety of places, capitalism is just a really bad way of organizing communism. Hence my claim in other episodes that capitalism is a form of anarchism, and that's a good thing. depending on what you mean by capitalism, etc. All right, but before I get into these three big organizational principles, communism, hierarchy, and exchange, I want to address a couple of emails that came in about the debt series. Both of them were critiques, and both of them were really helpful for me to think about what I'm doing and why. I guess what they really have in common is they showed me something that I was overlooking or misperceiving in my discussions of debt, and if I can get my responses to them right, I think it'll really help make clear what Graeber is doing and what I value in it, but also clarify the critique that I made of Graeber, especially in my conversation with Bill Maurer. These two critiques ended up touching on the same thing, I think, even though they seemed different at first, and that really makes it clear that I need to address this. The first email comes from the listener Brendan, and Brendan writes, "I have really taken the opportunity to reread Debt along with your series. I was blown away by the idea that money is not a human invention, but rather a human capacity, like math or language. The first complete paragraph of In Search of a Myth in Chapter 3 is particularly revelatory. I found the analysis of Chapter 3 good, but at the same time, this bit was left out. I find this to be the most radical and hopeful for the future of humanity." All right, so I got that email from Brendan saying that I had left out the most hopeful and revelatory bit. And I thought, huh, what's going on? So I went to that paragraph in Debt, of course, and here's the paragraph from Graeber. "The reason why anthropologists haven't been able to come up with a simple, compelling story for the origins of money is because there's no reason to believe there could be one. Money was no more ever invented than music or mathematics or jewelry. What we call money isn't a thing at all. It's a way of comparing things mathematically, as proportions, of saying one of X is equivalent to six of Y. As such, it is probably as old as human thought. The moment we try to get any more specific, we discover that there are any number of different habits and practices that have converged in the stuff we now call money. And that is precisely the reason why economists, historians, and the rest have found it so difficult to come up with a single definition." Now, when I went back and read this paragraph, I found it kind of banal and obvious. But I talked to a couple of people about it, and they agreed that it was profound. The problem, they said, was me. I've been reading Graeber and thinking about these issues so much that this paragraph just felt obvious. I've internalized it, but it's actually hugely important. When we do the kind of history that Graeber does in Debt, and that Graeber and Wingrow do in The Dawn of Everything, what we're looking for are these myths, these compelling stories of how things came to be. And of course, you know, I believe that things have origins and you can tell stories of how things came about. History can be done. But I also think that things don't have origins, that everything is new, that in some way, everything is a rupture with the past, and everything is old, and everything is in continuity with the past. That's why if you study music, say, you can find the points or ruptures that makes things new. This is when punk happened out of rock. This is when rock happened out of pop. This is when pop happened out of jazz. You could also argue, you know, pop never happened. It's just a version of jazz. Either way, you can take your pick. But you can make this pretty smooth claim. Rock became punk, or punk was never really different from rock. There are moments, of course, that are much harder, like when you try to explain how jazz happened out of Caribbean and West African rhythms and folk and ragtime and European brass horns. You end up, for me, with a huge rupture. I can't find a continuity there. That's why I just think this is one of those super special moments. But maybe that's just me. I'm not a music historian. You can also go further and further back to find the point in time when European music diverged from Indian music, say. Except I don't think you can actually find that time. You can see that the rupture happened, but who could actually tell that story? It's lost. But if you try and go further back to try and find when music was invented, you will find yourself making up a story like the state of nature theorists made up. It sounds kind of like Adam and Eve or the 2001 intro. You will just tell a really dumb story about a hominid or an ape hearing the winds blow through the reeds. And then he and the ape or the hominid is always a male in these how music was born stories. This hominid blew through the reed or something ridiculous like that. Or you can say that, you know, music. And you know what I mean by music. Real music. Not that earlier stuff that wasn't really music, like Athenian lyres and Gregorian chants. Music was born, capital M music, in Vienna in 1757. And that lets you tell a real story about the birth of music instead of this totally made-up story about an ape blowing in a reed. But it's also totally fake as a history of music and is, you know, it's going to be culturally imperialist to boot. And this is the problem that Debt solved. And it's the reason that the book got so much praise, even as aspects of it remain kind of unresolved. Graeber showed that money, which is also debt, has no origin. Economics textbooks tell us that the myth of barter, which is something close to that story about the ape blowing in the reed, and then they tell us, oh, this isn't a real story. But then they seem to act like it is a real story because they are confused between this kind of metaphor they are using and history. And Graeber showed, conclusively, I think, that this barter story is completely fake and that economists believe it even though they might say it's fake. And he does this through flashes of insight, like that paragraph Brendan pointed me to, but also through the historical origins of things. Which brings me to the second critique I received, which came from Simona. Simona objected to a bit of my conversation with Bill Maurer, that's episode 107, Debt Discussion number 3, in which I said something along the lines of, Graeber was always looking for the anarcho-communist utopia before civilization happened. And Simona pointed out, not only did Graeber not claim that there was an anarcho-communist utopia before civilization happened, that the point of the book, The Dawn of Everything, was to dispute that idea. Chapter 5 of Debt also sets out to attack this idea. Okay, I'm breaking in here to say that Simona and I exchanged several more emails about this, and I feel like I had a breakthrough, so I deleted my initial discussion of Simona's email and recorded this. Since I'm re-recording it, I probably won't be able to make it sound exactly like the rest of the episode, so sorry about that. So here's what I ultimately decided. Graeber is against the idea of origins, insofar as origins are these mythic things that have no histories, like the myth of barter. He wants to replace them with the real story of origins, which aren't births out of nothing, but complex histories of how certain things came out of the past, while also representing some sort of a rupture with it. So far, so good. The problem, and this is what I was trying to get at with that quip about the anarcho-communist utopias, is that it's very, very clear that Graeber thinks that something went wrong with history roughly 5,000 years ago, and he wants to undo it. Or to be more precise, he wants us to collectively undo it together. So that can make it seem like he's doing the thing that he's criticizing. And insofar as the historical record here is tiny, there almost isn't a historical record this far back. History is the written stories people tell, whereas things like archaeology is how we get at the unwritten stuff, and the further back you go, the less writing there is, therefore the less history there is. Graeber's stories can start to sound like the mythic origin stories that he is against. I think that's unavoidable, though, if you're going to do history in prehistory. I do think he treated this stuff as historically as he could, but I myself have never even tried to write anything about this era because it seems so difficult. A difficulty that Graeber acknowledges in his book, Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology. And I'll be asking someone who has thought about Graeber and this problem, Luke Kemp, about it in a future episode. All right, so what does all this mean? Let me give you a couple of examples. First, Simona pointed me to some absolutely fantastic work by the anthropologist Aicha Chibuchu. I'm probably not pronouncing that just right, but I'm doing my best. So Chibuchu writes about Graeber's Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology, and here's a long quote from her, which also includes quoting Graeber along the way. I'll try to make that clear. For Graeber, human history does not consist of a series of revolutions, be it the Neolithic Revolution, the Agricultural Revolution, the French Revolution, or the Industrial Revolution, that introduce clear social, moral, or political breaks in the nature of social reality, or, quote, the human condition, end quote, as he prefers to think of it. If this is the case, and if anarchism is above all an ethics of practice, as he asserts, such an ethics becomes available for anthropological study and political inspiration across human history. It is important to note, however, that Graeber passionately disagrees with primitivist anarchists inspired by his anthropologist mentor Marshall Solon's influential 1972 essay, The Original Affluent Society. Anarchists who propose, quote, there was a time when alienation and inequality did not exist, when everyone was a hunter-gathering anarchist, and that therefore real liberation can only come if we abandon civilization. That's the end of the Graeber quote within Chibuchu. In Fragments and the Dawn of Everything, he instead draws a more complex history of endless variety where, for instance, quoting Graeber, there were hunter-gatherer societies with nobles and slaves and agrarian societies that are fiercely egalitarian. End of that quote. Graeber insists, in other words, that, quote, humans never lived in the Garden of Eden. End of that quote. The significance of this finding is manifold. Among other things, it means that history can become a resource for us in much more interesting ways, and that radical theorists no longer have to pore endlessly over the same scant 200 years of revolutionary history. All right, that was another bit of Graeber, and that's the end of the Graeber quote and the end of the Chibuchu quote. The same scant 200 years of revolutionary history. So fascinating. I love it. I've been reading Hannah Arendt's book on revolution, and she and Hobsbawm sort of says the same thing. They're just very clear that revolution is a pretty new thing. It's a couple hundred years old. Therefore, the things that happened in the Roman Empire or Greece or China or Indonesia just aren't really revolutions if they happened before 1789. This is a dumb idea. All right, moving forward with my explanation. I don't think Chibuchu's piece requires much explanation, but it boils down to, I think, that Graeber is attacking this idea, and I must admit I take this idea more seriously than he did, that before civilization, everyone was just happy and healthy. They lived in the Garden of Eden. Marshall Solins was Graeber's mentor. They wrote a book together about kings, but Graeber absolutely did not believe in this hunter-gatherer utopia. You could have slave-holding hunter-gatherers, or you could have egalitarian, happy farmers. So the enemy here is not just this thing called progress and its myths. Once upon a time, people were hungry and sad but free. Then they invented farming, aka the agricultural revolution. Then they were content and placid but enslaved. But there's this other myth, the myth of anti-progress, which Graeber identifies with that Solins essay. Once upon a time, people were happy and full of food and free. Then the agricultural revolution happened, and they became hungry and sad and enslaved. These are both wrong, Graeber says, and I agree with him. But the additional complexity I need to add is that something that Graeber says is that things really seem to have gotten worse for most people in the world over the past 5,000 years. And we really can look to the times before the Roman Empire and other imperial constructions made things so terrible. Hence my quip, he's looking for the anarcho-communist utopia before civilization. He isn't really. But he's looking for the manifestations of different human conditions everywhere. And that includes past and present traditional societies, which is why it can make him look sort of like one of these anarcho-primitivists. He's also obviously looking for it where Bill Maurer said he should, in the everyday. That's the premise of this podcast. All right, let me conclude with a bit from The Dawn of Everything, which is the other key text here, along with fragments of An Anarchist Anthropology and Debt, to try and shed some more light on how this can feel like a contradiction. As Graeber and Wingrow write in Dawn about the noble savage myth, this is the anti-progress myth, noble savages are ultimately just as boring as savage ones. More to the point, neither actually exist. But they also point this out. Many settlers captured by indigenous societies during colonial North America ended up preferring indigenous societies. But pretty much all the Indians captured by the colonial settlers ended up preferring indigenous societies. So there is no Garden of Eden. There are no noble savages. There is no anarchist communist utopia before history. But we do live in a very fucked up society, and when people get alternatives to it, they prefer those alternatives. Graeber is looking, among other places, for alternatives in traditional societies. We do this all the time. Al-Andalus, we look for that as an image of cosmopolitanism. We look for Norway and Denmark as a better form of socialism if we're Americans. We look for Athens as a better form of doing education and an athletic way of life. People do this all the time. We find societies that look like superior alternatives to the conditions we have now. That doesn't mean we are looking for the Garden of Eden. What it means is we are doing history. It's just that doing history in the murky mists of prehistory looks a lot like the hunt for the Garden of Eden. But in my email exchange with Simona, I've been convinced that that's not what Graeber is doing. All right, that was this interlude. Now back to those three different ways of organizing society. Now I'll bring this back around to chapter 5, where Graeber explains these three ways of organizing society: communism, hierarchy, and exchange, or reciprocity. Let's get started with communism, and we'll see how this mythic way of working plays out. All right, so first a funny bit. Graeber writes that he knows using the word communism is provocative, quote, because we tend to identify it with communist regimes. He also points out that those regimes, the Soviets, the Warsaw Bloc countries, China, Cuba, etc., claimed that they weren't communist. They had communist parties, but the societies were merely socialist, and they were working towards communism, which was, as Graeber puts it, distant, somewhat fuzzy utopian ideal to be accompanied by the withering away of the state. That's the end of the quote, and I want to say, this is why, by the way, I always point out that the anarchists and the Marxists want exactly the same thing. Marxists are always trying to seize the state and make it do stuff, but according to Marx, we don't need a state. Marxists should be against the state, except as the most temporary necessity possible. Good luck finding any actually existing Marxists who hate the state, though. All right, so this far future utopia, Graeber says, is matched up with a fuzzy far past utopia of communism, mythic communism, primitive communism that existed before the creation of private property. It's a reverse version of the state of nature. Hobbes and Locke say the state of nature is the war of all against all. The primitive communists, the mythic communists, say that the state of nature was the cooperation of all with all. Here we are again. This is where Simona called me out for suggesting that Graeber believed in this myth when this chapter is against this myth. He obviously didn't believe in it, or he wouldn't say that private property, like money or music, is a human capacity. It doesn't need to be invented. And yet. He also argues that communism, this from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs, is the baseline of all societies. So though he argues that, quote, a society organized exclusively along that single principle, close quote, is probably impossible, he also argues that all societies are organized around communism. But, and I'll try and drop this idea for now, I really do think he makes it clear that things were more communistic in most societies before the rise of the big empires 5,000 years ago. So there's no golden age, he says, but he kind of also implies that there was a golden age. But also, he says he doesn't believe it. I think you can read him as arguing for a golden age. And also, it's very clear he's not trying to do it. Let's just leave it at that for now. All right. So if you've listened to the introduction of this podcast, the podcast series, or this episode, you know where this is going. Everything operates on baseline communism. Graeber calls this the raw material of sociality. But we are also always more communistic with some people than others. Graeber mentions how, you know, mother's love is the standard example of how communist people are. Mothers just give to their kids and love them. I think if you've read Kristen Godsey's book, Everyday Utopia, that shows that this sort of heteronormative, nuclear, family, self-sacrificing mothers, that's just a cultural construct. It doesn't have to be mother's love, but if you live in one of the societies defined by mother's love that way, that's a good example. No matter what society you live in, communism is weaker and stronger with different people. So society is crisscrossed, as Graeber puts it, with weaker and stronger bonds. Your bond is stronger with your family than your next-door neighbor, and maybe stronger with your coworkers than your neighbor, too, and probably stronger with the coworkers you work with more closely than your other coworkers, but stronger with them than other people who work in the same industry, etc. Everyone is in a communistic relationship with everyone else, but also we have stronger and weaker forms of communism. And that leads to Graeber's three lessons about baseline communism. All right, first this quote. First, we're not really dealing with reciprocity here, or at best, only reciprocity in the broadest sense. What is equal on both sides is the knowledge that the person would do the same for you, not that they necessarily will. All right, that's the end of the quote. And this is just so important, because baseline communism, or as Kropotkin called it, mutual aid, can look like exchange. Murray Bookchin argued that mutual aid is exchange. But I'm with Graeber. It isn't exchange at all. For reasons that we will see later, you're not trading with someone and you're not expecting something from them in return. You're just always going to help them as long as you are alive, as long as your neighborhood exists, as long as there are people, you're always going to be giving and receiving, and you're never keeping accounts. All right, now the second claim, and here's the Graeber quote. The second point has to do with the famous law of hospitality. There is a peculiar tension between a common stereotype of what are called primitive societies, people lacking both states and markets, as societies in which anyone not a member of the community is assumed to be an enemy, and also the frequent accounts of early European travelers awestruck by the extraordinary generosity shown to them by actual savages. Granted, there is a certain truth to both sides. All right, that's the end of the quote. So Graeber goes on to explain that if your default mode is baseline communism, it is very, very important to know when you've crossed that line into hostility. If you will give any stranger a bed in your home, as long as they're not literally an enemy, you have to have really clear rules about who is an enemy and who isn't. Hence the strict rule that if you exchange meals, you aren't an enemy. We find this rule in so many societies because it's a way of clearing up. If you're going to be a communist with everyone except for the people who are literally trying to kill you, you better make sure the people who are feeding you and you are feeding aren't enemies. So the hospitality that Europeans experienced when they were visiting these so-called primitive societies was just baseline communism. Or sometimes there was like an elaborate feast, a ritual version of baseline communism to clearly express we are on the same team. We are in this together. In some cases, it went the other way, the denial of hospitality, but that was much rarer. Baseline communism is so powerful that you have to make sure that you are not in solidarity with someone who is hostile to you. That's why the primitive societies seem to be so contradictory when actually it's pretty common sense. Share with everyone, except for the people who are out to get you. Finally, the third thing. If you want to have the system that we supposedly have, exchange, reciprocity, liberalism, capitalism, these are all roughly words for the same thing. You actually have to have baseline communism. My example for this, Graeber doesn't use the example, I don't think. Think of all the gangster movies or spy movies in which two sides are making a deal. Someone's selling a briefcase filled with information. And then one side tries to kill the other and keep both of them. This doesn't actually happen very often in real life. Even if you use Facebook Marketplace, the person you are buying or selling from doesn't seem to be trying to rip you off. You simply can't have exchanges like this without baseline communism. Just like you can't have sports competitions without baseline communism. Everyone has to agree to the rules and agree to follow the ref. Or in a pickup game, agree to follow the rules without a ref. You can't have elections without baseline communism. That's obviously what's going wrong in the United States. The competitive nature of election only works within the cooperative nature of communism. If the communism goes away, then you can't really have a competition. You just have a hated war between two sides, which is what we have in the United States right now and is why people are talking about civil war. I don't think civil war is coming, but it feels that way because the communism part is not being upheld very well. Those are my examples. Here's how Graeber puts it. Once we start thinking of communism as a principle of morality rather than just a question of property ownership, it becomes clear that this sort of morality is almost always at play to some degree in any transaction. For example, merchants often reduce prices for the needy. These are the people, of course, this is me. The merchants are precisely supposed to be the least communistic. They're just buying and selling, except they behave in communistic ways. And then Graeber tells this delightful folk story about the Sufi mystic Nasruddin, who I wasn't familiar with before, but now I'm a big fan of him. A Turkish folktale about the medieval Sufi mystic Nasruddin Hoca illustrates the complexities thus introduced into the very concept of supply and demand. One day, when Nasruddin was left in charge of the local tea house, the king and some retainers who had been hunting nearby stopped in for breakfast. "Do you have quail eggs?" asked the king. "I'm sure I can find some," answered Nasruddin. The king ordered an omelet of a dozen quail eggs, and Nasruddin hurried out to look for them. After the king and his party had eaten, he charged them 100 gold pieces. The king was puzzled. Are quail eggs really that rare in this part of the country? "It's not so much quail eggs that are rare around here," Nasruddin replied. "It's more visits from kings." All right, so this is me, you know, supply and demand doesn't make sense when there's a king in the mix. We'll get another Nasruddin story and we'll elaborate on this story later, but this brings us to the idea of exchange. Exchange is the second way of organizing society that Graeber mentions. And as we've already seen, you can't have it without baseline communism. Once you do have baseline communism, here are the characteristics of exchange or reciprocity that Graeber establishes. First, quote, it's all about equivalence. Every trade is supposed to be even. It's supposed to be a fair trade. That's what exchange is. It's evenness. And yet, as Graeber also points out, the whole point of exchange is to get a better deal than the other person. So there is a paradox at the heart of exchange, that it's supposed to be an even trade, but the only reason to do it is if it is an uneven trade. All right, here's another big difference between exchange and baseline communism. Graeber says that exchange is time limited. With your neighbor or family or coworker, you just sort of assume that the relationship will go on forever and it will work out for everyone in the long run. And if your coworker leaves before they've paid you that favor back, you don't hand them a bill. You just accept that things go on. Baseline communism, thus, as Graeber puts it, partakes of a certain notion of eternity. But in exchange, the entire relationship can be canceled out. You have to be in baseline communism, at least imagining your community is always going to exist, whereas you can end the relationship in exchange, in reciprocity, at any moment. The example I thought of when I read this is, I worked at a school and I was doing some travel, and the business manager told me that how to recognize a receipt. I thought I knew what a receipt was, but I didn't. He said if it was a receipt, it had to say zero balance. It had to be the end of a relationship. It couldn't just be a charge for something. There had to be a charge for something, an identical payment, and then a zero. Look at the receipts in your life. They always say zero at the end of it. There is a clear end. Relationship over. You did this, I did that, we're done. Everyone gets to walk away. Or as Graeber puts it, exchange allows us to cancel out our debts, to call it even, hence to end the relationship. With neighbors, one might for this very reason prefer not to pay one's debts. Right, so we can see the example of this. It's always best to owe your neighbor a little something, or have your local bar owe you a little something, or always have a credit with your local bar, or always have your neighbor owe you a little something. If you're in baseline communism, but you're pretending it's an exchange, someone always has the chance to zero out, and you don't want that because you want to still be in this relationship with them. So if you're buying beer for your friends, try and always buy an odd number of rounds. That way someone will always owe someone and you can keep exchanging, if you're structuring your sharing to look like exchanging. On the other hand, as Graeber points out, sometimes what looks like exchanging can turn into something else, a competition. Quote, things can easily slip into games of one-upmanship, and hence obsession, humiliation, rage, or as we'll see, even worse. All right, we'll get to the even worse that he gives you in that quote later. The point here is that if your friend gives you a really, really expensive present, you might just feel like they're generous, but you also might feel like they're taunting you with their larger salary. That's the danger of structuring your mutual aid as exchange. People can get pissed off if they get too bad of a deal. They can also get pissed off if they get too good of a deal. Resentment happens. And we've already seen, this is the worst, what happens when a king is involved. In the story of Nasruddin and the quail eggs, the king got a really bad deal. And it worked out because the king was a giver and he was just a different type of person and he let it go. But when the king is the receiver, it goes very differently. Here's another Nasruddin story from Graeber. Nasruddin was once called up to visit the king. A neighbor saw him hurrying along the road carrying a bag of turnips. "Who are those for?" he asked. "I've been called to the king. I thought it would be best to bring some kind of present." "You're bringing him turnips? But turnips are a peasant food. He's a king. You should bring him something more appropriate, like grapes." Nasruddin agreed and came to the king carrying a bunch of grapes. The king was not amused. "You're giving me grapes, but I am a king. That is ridiculous. Take this idiot out and teach him some manners. Throw each and every one of the grapes at him and then kick him out of the palace." The Emperor's guards dragged Nasruddin into a side room and began pelting him with grapes. As they did so, he fell on his knees and began crying, thank you, God, for your infinite mercy. Why are you thanking God? They asked. You're being totally humiliated. Nasruddin replied, oh, I was just thinking. Thank God I didn't bring the turnips. Okay, sorry for giggling at this little story, imagining Nasruddin getting pelted with hard peasant turnips as opposed to aristocratic, but I guess not kingly, grapes. All right, so the point of both this grape story and the quail egg story is that kings simply can't play the game of exchange. As Graeber puts it, the objects being traded are seen as equivalent. Therefore, by implication, so are the people. At least at the moment when money changes hands, when there is no more further debt or obligation, and each of the two parties is equally free to walk away. This in turn implies autonomy. Both principles sit uncomfortably with monarchs. That's the end of the quote. Exchange is done between equals voluntarily. Kings aren't supposed to be equal with their subjects, and the subjects aren't supposed to be able to do things voluntarily. This is why kings don't buy quail eggs at local restaurants and why they give gifts in the forms of bread and circuses or festivals, not in terms of exchanges. Kings can't do exchange except maybe with other kings. What they can do, though, is our third big organizational system, hierarchy. Graeber starts off with another one of these origin myths that's also not meant to be an origin myth by suggesting that hierarchy, you know, these are like just so stories that help us think through without positing that they are actually historical reality. I'm still struggling with this distinction. Okay, back to the idea. To understand hierarchy, think about it first in kind of a state of nature when there are no social relations. The purest negative form of hierarchy is theft or plunder. The purest positive form is a charitable gift. As Graeber puts it, only a lunatic would mug his next door neighbor. If you're just going to use force to get something from someone, it has to be someone you don't know. And the highest form of charity is often argued to be anonymous. I know Maimonides says this. In short, if you are taking something or giving something, no exchange, no sharing, no communism, just purely taking or purely giving, you damn well better not know who they are, and they shouldn't know who you are. Because if they do know who you are, and you know who they are, you are going to get what Graeber calls a logic of precedent. This is the most interesting bit of the hierarchy subchapter for me. If communism operates on the principle of perpetual mutual aid, and exchange operates on the principle of temporary equality and autonomy, hierarchy operates on precedent. Graeber tells a story that he can't confirm, but is too good not to share. I have been told that in some of the more lawless parts of the former Soviet Union, gangs prey so systematically on travelers on trains and buses that they have developed a habit of giving each victim a little token to confirm the bearer has already been robbed. Obviously, one step toward the creation of the state. All right, that's the end of that little story, but do you remember way back at the beginning of the series when Graeber tells the story of kings giving their soldiers a gold coin and then demanding a gold coin from each peasant, and then that way the peasants feed the soldiers? This token is the same thing. Your tax forms are the proof that you've already been robbed by the government. And guess what? You can assume that your taxes are going to be pretty similar next year. And when they change, there's a revolution. That's the logic of precedent. Once you get to know the people that you are robbing, and you start robbing them every day or every year, you start systematizing the relationship. It's not as equals, but it's definitely morality. That's why gangsters call it protection, not robbing. Or as Graeber puts it, conquest, untrammeled force, becomes systematized and thus framed not as a predatory relation, but a moral one, with the lords providing protection and the villagers their sustenance. And this is the really interesting thing. I didn't see this before. The argument about sustenance and protection is always about how much the peasants paid last year. Precedence is the only tool for arguing about what the sides owe, because exchange and communism don't work in this kind of hierarchy. It's exactly the same if you're giving. If you give to a charitable organization once, they will hound you forever, as he says happened with him when he gave to the United Farm Workers. You owe us. That's how hierarchy works. they owe you and you own us. So if you're giving to someone who is below you, they will keep expecting you to give them over and over again. If you're giving charity, it's from this lofty moral position, but then they say, you owe us. And God, will they hound you. And this logic of precedent is how we get different types of people. Caste systems. As Graeber puts it, the moment we recognize someone as a different sort of person, either above or below us, the ordinary rules of reciprocity become modified or are put aside. All right, one last thing about hierarchy from Graeber before we get to debt and the conclusion of the chapter. The hierarchical person in charge is going to take in a lot of money. But that doesn't make them a villain. In fact, and this is the basic argument of social democracy, maybe also democratic socialism, the head of state could actually be a redistributionist and take money and then give it to the people. This is common in certain other societies, Graeber says. Quote, in much of Papua New Guinea, social life centers on big men, charismatic individuals who spend much of their time coaxing, cajoling, and manipulating in order to acquire great masses of wealth to give away again at some great feast. He also mentions North American Indian chiefs who work roughly the same way, and quote, a village chief was often the poorest man in the village. Such was the pressure on him for a constant supply of largesse. And then obviously the industrial democracy version of this is social democracy, in which the robber state, which is built by the king originally, can choose to rob from the rich and give to the poor in forms of healthcare, UBI, jobs guarantees, public housing, etc. Or as Graeber puts it, the genealogy of the modern redistributive state, with its notorious tendency to foster identity politics, can be traced back not to any sort of primitive communism, but ultimately to violence and war. I left this part out of the script, and then I put it back in, and I was tempted to leave it out, but I'll do this anyways. It seems to me, again, this is Graeber having it both ways. Instead of saying that the modern redistributive state is a way to do equality, that we can organize our society any way we want, and one way to make it fair is through social democracy, he seems to think that we should value it less once we know its genealogical connection is to violence and war. I think he's trying to have it both ways again. I may get another email from Simona. Maybe I'll have her on at some point. We can hash this out. All right, enough of that. To the conclusion of the chapter. Graeber ends with a section called Shifting Between Modalities. The argument is that we are all, quote, communists with our closest friends and feudal lords when dealing with small children. His point is we are very comfortable using all of these things. Reciprocity, exchange, hierarchy, and communism. They all exist for all of us. The police are hierarchical within the police, but they're also communistic within the police. In some ways, they are above the citizens. In some way, they are below the citizens. They also exchange favors with one another in reciprocity. The police, or anyone anywhere, shift between different modalities constantly. But Graeber thinks that we haven't noticed that we use these different modalities, and whenever we try to explain society, we do it in reciprocity. Your mother loves you, and you have to pay her back, is one of his examples, which obviously is dumb. He says that even medieval thinkers had a phrase, some pray, some fight, still others work, as if knights, priests, and peasants were all sort of equal and they were balanced in a, quote, elegant geometry. This idea that everything is reciprocity and exchange and it all balances out is obviously laughable. It is also, despite being so comically wrong, the basis of the field of economics. As Graeber puts it, economists are aware that reality is always more complicated, but they are also aware that to come up with a mathematical model, one always has to make the world into a bit of a cartoon. And I'm okay with simplification. That's what any system or ideology is, a simplification. Except then the economists act like it's not a cartoon. And going back to Graeber, quote, our economic system is one vast network of reciprocal relations in which, in the end, the accounts balance and all debts are paid. That's the end of the quote. And I'll have a discussion of debt and economics and how that doesn't work with the economist James K. Galbraith posted soon. The point is, in this specific moment, that the model that economists have in their head is that everything, no matter what, is always going to balance and be even. And if billionaires exist and other people are starving, somehow there is equality and reciprocity. As I always say, that's just dumb. But what Graeber is focused on here is how difficult it is to shift from reciprocity or exchange to communism, even though it's really easy to shift from communism to exchange. In a commune, it's so easy for the person who is contributing the most to become the leader by accident. Things like this happen in Ursula K. Le Guin's The Dispossessed, and it happened to Jane Addams at Hull House, and she wrote about this, and Tolstoy was pretty mean to her about it. She just was trying to be one of many, but everyone was looking to her as the leader, so she became the leader, and she didn't really have a way to fix it. So communism slides into reciprocity. Everyone owed Jane Addams more, and then reciprocity slides into hierarchy. Jane Addams is in charge of Hull House. It's pretty hard to go from reciprocity to communism. If you're in a friendship and someone is taking or giving too much, either way, it really doesn't matter whether you're benefiting or losing. As Graeber says, it's often much easier to break off relations entirely than to demand that they somehow pay you back. Or I would add, to offer somehow to pay them back. When this kind of friendly mutual aid gets unbalanced, it starts to feel less like perpetual communism and more like a system of equal exchange in which one side isn't pulling their weight. If it's 2024, you just ghost them. But in a society like ancient Rome or medieval China, these are Graeber's examples, you might switch the relationship from reciprocity to hierarchy, just like happened with Jane Addams. In Bullshit Jobs, Graeber argues that this exists now in corporations. Vice presidents want as many people reporting to them as possible because it looks good to be a patron, even if it's not financially sensible. If you have a boss, they owe you everything. Without you, no one would do the work. But you owe them everything. Without them, you wouldn't have a job. And this switch, I mean, sometimes when you get hired, it feels kind of even, but then as soon as you start, the two equals negotiating switches to this thing where you are a subordinate. It creates something. It creates hierarchy. It creates different classes of people, and it creates debt. Here's the last big quotes from Graeber. Debt is a very specific thing, and it arises from very specific situations. It first requires a relationship between two people who do not consider each other fundamentally different sorts of being, who are equals in those ways that are really important, and who are not currently in a state of equality, but for whom there is some way to set matters straight. This connection becomes clear if we look at the etymology of common words for debt in European languages. Many are synonyms of fault, sin, or guilt. Just as a criminal owes a debt to society, a debtor is always a sort of criminal. In ancient Crete, according to Plutarch, it was the custom for those taking loans to pretend to snatch the money from the lender's purse. Why, he wondered? Probably, and this is Graeber quoting Plutarch, so that if they default, they could be charged with violence and punished all the more. End of Plutarch. This is why in so many periods of history, insolvent debtors could be jailed, or even, as in early Republican Rome, executed. A debt, then, is just an exchange that has not been brought to completion. It follows that debt is strictly a creature of reciprocity and has little to do with other sorts of morality. Communism, with its needs and abilities, hierarchy, with its customs and qualities. True, if we were really determined, we could argue, as some do, that communism is a condition of permanent mutual indebtedness or that hierarchy is constructed of unpayable debts. But isn't this just the same old story, starting from the assumption that all human interactions must be, by definition, forms of exchange, and then performing whatever mental somersaults are required to prove it? All right, I'm going to stop there. And my favorite part of this chapter, besides the part that inspired this entire podcast, is when he goes through what please and thank you and merci mean. But this episode is long enough. I'll just let you discover that stuff. Back to debt. Debt is what allows us, Graeber says, to pretend that things that are not equality are actually equality. We could, of course, organize our society without debts, or with debt as a really minor part of it, but to do that, we would mostly need to use communism and or hierarchy. And in liberal, capitalist, democracy, whatever we're calling this, we are told that communism is either wrong or impossible, sometimes both, and that hierarchy is bad and wrong, even though, of course, capitalism seems to always turn into feudal hierarchies. So if everyone is always autonomous and equal, but we don't want the world to descend into anarchy, or what Graeber would call primordial chaos, or the war of all against all, but I like confusing things by using the word anarchy here also, because that's how people imagine primordial chaos as anarchy. We've got to find a way to bind people into mutually beneficial exchanges that can be sustained. And so if we want to imagine that everything is based on reciprocity and exchange, we absolutely have to use debt to hold the world together. But that's only if we accept the claims of economists about how the world works. And this insight got me thinking into how hard it is to explain to people concepts like classes and exploitations. And it's because, especially if you're an American, we believe so deeply in individuals and exchanges, even though we've created the system of capitalism that reduces people to classes and create these enormous hierarchies. But we pretend that billionaires are balancing things rather than just being feudal lords. And I thought of this great essay by the anarchist Randolph Bourne, who wrote this about a century ago. I'm going to try and give you just a few quotes that capture it. So Bourne writes, I think this is in 1916, something like that, during World War I. "My Western friend who runs a prosperous stove factory has been finding fault with my insistent use of the word exploitation. My outlook on life is not sufficiently cheerful, and I am inclined to see malevolence, where everything is, as they say at college, healthy, hearty, and happy. He does not imprison his men. They come freely to him and ask for employment. He gives them such compensation as makes the jobs attractive to them, in competition with all other jobs in city and country. He is fair and scrupulous. But as long, I tell him, as the employer is entrenched in property rights with the armed state behind him, the power will be his, and the class that does the diverting will not be labor. My friend, however, does not like these Nietzschean terms. He is sure that his workmen have just as much power to exploit him as he has of exploiting them." Okay, that's the end of the Bourne quote. And it just, the connection here to Graeber is just astonishing me. These are the values of liberalism, of capitalism, of exchange. Everyone is equal. And somehow it just worked out that it seems like the workers are totally unequal and starving. But what are you going to do? Are you going to destroy equality and oppress the factory owner? You must be a vicious person who hates equality. This is exactly like the old joke from Anatole France. Quote, "In its majestic equality, the law forbids rich and poor alike to sleep under bridges, beg in the streets, and steal loaves of bread." This language of equality only works if people aren't actually locked into permanent inequalities. And debt lets you lock people into permanent inequalities while pretending that we are living in a world of equality. And that's why liberals, whose values I love, always seem to be defending exploitation, because they can't see that this equality they love is creating a form of hierarchy. But what's worse, it's a form of hierarchy that denies that it is actually hierarchy, just like Randolph Bourne's friends. And that's why feudal benevolence can look so radical and seem to have slid into social democracy, because you can find laws that say there is no such thing as majestic equality. But they also say that the peasants can get upset if they are starving, because it's the landlord's job to make sure they have food. Graeber and I think Eleanor Yanaga agrees that these laws usually aren't followed, but at least there's the idea in hierarchy that both sides are supposed to give and get something. Not give and get equally. Some work, others pray. But everyone is supposed to get what they need, and hierarchy becomes a little bit a form of communism. And it does seem like there are kind of anarchistic versions of capitalism that we can imagine in which things actually do balance out. But we would have to be working constantly to make sure, using socialism, that they balance out. And the economists tell us that if we try and balance things out, we're actually going to ruin the balance. So now we've seen the flaw in the world that economists have imagined, which is an equality that cannot ever be tampered with. Of course, the first few chapters of this book have demolished that claim. So now it's time to build a different account of how the world works, and we'll be doing that starting in chapter 6, Games with Sex and Death. Remember, you can find me at everydayanarchism.com. You can email me questions at everydayanarchismpodcast@gmail.com. Hopefully I'll answer them in a future episode. And of course, the music that you are about to hear is by David Hill.